Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm executive director of the Puerto Rico Project. I specialize in harm reduction. And what I have here are naloxone kits, which has the medication to reverse an opioid overdose. I have fentanyl test kits where people could test their drug for fentanyl. And I have deactivation drug kits where people could throw drugs in here, shake it up, and then their drugs, like they never existed. So say, for example, I'm running from the police and I have a whole bunch of drugs. I could throw it in here, shake it, and they will never know. And then I have condoms. I have female condoms, lubricant, and I have dental dams. And then instruction packets on how to reverse the overdose. And, of course, I'm a trainer. I do street outreach. So it's out of my car. I drive to mostly in high crime areas to homeless encampments where people are using drugs. And they, I'm a syringe access program as well for people living in the street. And I pass out brand new syringes so they don't pass HIV and Hep C amongst one another.
Do it independently, or you're funded by some larger group?
I do it independently.
Background.
I'm a CADC. I'm a counselor. I'm director of outreach at a outpatient treatment program, and I run my own nonprofit called the Puerto Rico Project, and I specialize in harm reduction. So my organization was brought about because I don't know if you heard of the situation with Puerto Rico trafficking folks to Chicago to receive treatment services, and they ended up in unlicensed programs here, and they ended up in our street, and they ended up dying, and they ended up in our programs. So I created a nonprofit with wraparound services. So I pass out food, I pass out clothes, I pass out harm reduction supplies, and Sharps containers and stuff, and I collect it for them as well.
How many of these naloxone do you pass out a month?
On a month, I would say maybe about 100. I outreach in the west side and south side, back of the yards, Little Village, Pilsen, and in those areas.
You ever go down on North Michigan Avenue where they do drugs too?
Oh, well, no. No, no. Not over there.
And how long have you been doing it?
About 5 years.
5 years. Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We're in Freedom Square, kitty corner from Holman Square. Police warehouse, torture center, black site, site of many disappeared teens, place where the Chicago police practices the black arts, illegality, violation of the Constitution and human rights. It's a place that was exposed some years ago and still operates. Place that these people, Black Abolition Movement and many other supporting groups have gathered. Again, fed up with the delays that the City Council of Chicago has constantly thrown up. They found no shortage of excuses why they allow the police impunity. No shortage of excuses as to how they can pay out hundreds of millions of dollars in civil suits settled against the City of Chicago and the police department for criminal behavior. They found no shortage of excuses for why they don't hold killer cops, abusive cops, psychologically unqualified cops accountable. And why this so-called police union, so-called because it crosses every union picket line it's ever encountered, so-called police union, the Fraternal Order of the Police, which finds no limits to the funds that they're able to assemble to defend the rotten apples, which they claim are the few in the barrel, which they do their best to keep people from removing. Some moving speeches from groups have set up tables promoting the kind of justice work they do. Quite a bit of cultural programming here. Some music ongoing now. There's food. There's water. There's medical supplies. People are out here sharing. People are calling for real safety, real security. And they want it armed with love, not 9mm. At the intersection, the police have set up city salt truck blocking access to one of the cross streets. Traffic moves on Holman. Probably 400 people here. More coming, quite a few on bikes. Bikes stolen by Chicago police at an earlier action. And these bikes are being held at Holman Square.
Sure. I mean, to me, like the whole issue of like police brutality and like, you know, especially against like black people, essentially, it's just like something that's so egregious that you cannot be out, right? Like when someone goes like, oh, you know, the police are being brutal towards people, like why are you going out? That's kind of like the point, right? Like it's something that's so egregious that we just like tolerate as a society or a group of people. But like, if you just look at it from like an objective stance, just people, like especially the state doing that to people, it's just unacceptable, whether it's against like black people or like striking workers or really anyone. Like it's just a gross breach of like the social contract. I'm not black, but that's part of the reason why. But I mean, that's an even bigger reason to come out if you're not a bigger reason, but that is a big reason to come out, especially if you're not, you know, from a community or you're not someone that's been the victim of, like, you know, police misconduct and like violence from the state. Because if they can do it to one group of people, eventually they're just going to turn it on everyone else. Like what the police are doing in the U.S. now is what the U.S. was working on doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and you know, countless other countries 10-20 years ago, and now that's come home to roost. When the empire tests those tactics abroad, eventually it will come home. And that logic also applies to if the empire can use that against a certain type of people, then eventually it'll just get used on everyone. I mean, that's the kind of transactional way to look at it, aside from the fact that it's just, you know, the right thing to do, like, in terms of people's basic human rights and fighting for everyone's, you know, equal treatment, both in the law and in society. But
are you normally an activist?
I don't know. I mean, I'm in college, so it's hard to, you know, come out to things often when the year's in, when classes are going on. I mean, I've come out to a few protests, both in the current, you know, this summer and then before. I guess I'm kind of like a very, very part-time. Yeah, but yeah. Basically, if these things happen, if these, you know, brutalities and atrocities happen without contest, without some sort of pushback, then that's just a green light, right? Like, there's no, like, someone getting beaten or shot or illegally detained on the street, to me, is intimately related to, like, the federal government spying on us. Like, it's the same system that views violence and surveillance and brutality as a means to control people through fear. Because, I mean, in any capitalist state, the police are just... I'm trying not to hit anyone because I gesture a lot. The police are just a tool to protect the existing order, and that existing order is capitalism. Like, we all live in one country. And, like, everyone in the world lives in one country now, and that's capitalism. So, you know, when... Right. So, like, when a young black kid gets beaten on the street in the U.S., to me, that it's the same struggle as when a Palestinian kid gets beaten, or when a black kid in the U.S. gets shot. It's the same as any other oppressed person being oppressed simply so they can be exploited, so they can be used as cheap labor. They can be used as an example to the rest of us to toe the line, right?
So, bringing us back to wrongful convictions, the reason why we're here right now talking about these documents is because a man named Charles Green was locked up, lost 24 years of his life in prison. And he says that he was coerced into a confession, which he was then in prison for, what, like, assisting in a quadruple murder. It was bullshit. It is super bullshit. And since he got out from Stateville in 2009, he has been trying to clear his name. And he's not just trying to clear his name, he's trying to get these documents released going back to 1967 so that everyone who wants to investigate a wrongful incarceration can do that without having to go through the difficult legal process. So, in September, the city council will be voting on a settlement. They're trying to pay him $500,000. And listen, he deserves a lot more money than that, right? But the city council, or the city of Chicago, tried to slide into the settlement agreement. We're not going to release these records, even though a judge ordered them to release the records in January. So we cannot let city council pass the settlement the way that it is, or the city of Chicago get away without releasing the records en masse.
Yeah. The last thing I want to do is I just want to uplift two things. There's a lot of sexual assault at the hands of the police. And a lot of times when people are thinking about police violence, we are not usually thinking about violence against Black women, Black girls, trans folks, GNC folks, because that happens quite a bit. And a lot of those narratives, because of the way that the CPD categorizes their data, that's what's lost. That's what's lost. Jason Van Dyke had a history of racial slurs. That was lost because we did not have records. We need documents in order to learn those kinds of details. Thank you so much. You can find me, Trinity.
Shout out to the artist that worked on this board, Asha, yes. Angela Ray. You can help us too if you want. Come talk to us.
Yes. Come find us. We will be posting things on social media. This is Myra AK on Instagram and Twitter. Myra KA on Instagram and Twitter. Trinity Trill on Instagram and Twitter. And we will be posting things proactively because we only have a month to force the hand of the city.
Mic check. Mic check. Okay, so please listen up. CPD is saying that someone in the crowd has overdosed. We know that CPD lies about everything all the time. We also know that we care about our people. So I need to know, is everyone okay?
Yeah.
Is the person that you came here with okay?
Yeah.
Is the person next to you okay?
Yeah.
No, I need you to take a hot minute. Is the person next to you okay? Is the person in the cluster, five people next to you, okay? So, this is what's happening. The police are saying that they need to infiltrate what is happening right now. Okay. So, I just got a real-time update, because this is how it goes, y'all. The person who is of question is being treated right now by our medics. Because who got us? Who got us?
We got us.
Who got us?
We got us.
Before I introduce the next person, I need to be very, very, very clear with y'all. The police want to get up in here right now. I don't know if you can see, but they are right behind you with their riot gear looking goofy as hell. I need you to look out for each other. This is abolition 101 for me. I'll speak for myself. My abolition 101 means I look after the person that I am next to. So we need to make sure we are hydrated. We are making sure we're good. We do not talk to the police at all. We do not engage with the police at all. Do you understand? Thank you. You will see people engaging with the police. That is because they are police liaisons for today, and that is their role. If you are not a police liaison for today, do not engage. They do not exist. They will lie. They will beat. They will torture. We know this. We know this. Thank you.
Hey, real quick, y'all, real quick, I just gotta know one thing. What side are you on, my people? What side are you on? What side are you on, my people? What side are you on? What side are you on, my people? What side are you on?
The
side of Shakur was a freedom fighter, and she taught me how to fight.
You just spoke from the stage.
Thank you.
You spoke about the records that are being held back that are used to protect criminal cops,
mm-hmm.
and cover up a whole range of assaults on
mm-hmm.
citizens.
Right.
Can you say your name and the group you're with?
Yeah, I'm Myra Quadra, and I'm not with any one group, but I'm with the Release the Records campaign. And the Release the Records campaign is a bunch of organizations are in support of this, mostly Black and abolitionist led. And the records actually are by law already open to the public, right? But the way that they get released right now is that individuals have to make specific requests and they go through a very long process that is not accessible. A judge in January ordered the city to release all the records going back to 1967 en masse. And the city has dragged its feet and has not done that. Additionally, we found out last week that in settling that case, they tried to get out of this judge's order. And there's no legal grounds for that. One, like not just from Green versus Chicago, but Calvin versus Chicago said that all police misconduct files are public. And in the Illinois Supreme Court in June 2020, the Supreme Court ruled that the public importance of these documents outweighs anything that the FOP's bargaining agreement says.
The issue, as I understood it, there was a work contract between the Fraternal Order of the Police and the City of Chicago, and the city conceded to allowing records of police to be sealed after 5 years as a part of the work agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that is that many cops who shouldn't be cops and who had long histories of doing things that should have gotten them off the force were protected from the public scrutiny, the scrutiny of lawyers who may have been defending people damaged by those cops. And we know in the case of Jason Van Dyke,
mm-hmm.
something similar.
Right. So it's one thing is that in the police, like police officers are protected from their disciplinary records from affecting their employment, right? So like only the case at hand is used to make decisions. Not Dante Servin's past was not used in the hearing that was going to happen for him. It wasn't going to include his previous records. So they're protected from previous misconduct, which is a problem. From misconduct, being held accountable for previous misconduct, which is a problem. But the FOP bargaining agreement, and there's some confusion about this, but there should not be any confusion. Section 8.4 said that documents over 5 to 7 years would be destroyed. That's been a long legal battle that was just resolved in the Illinois Supreme Court in June. And the Supreme Court decided that the public importance of these records outweighs what the collective bargaining agreement says, because we are under consent decree and we need these documents to inform any of the reforms that are going to happen. So the public importance is protected. We do not, like, they're not allowed to destroy the documents anymore. A judge ordered the city to stop withholding them and release them to the public. And they've already been public under Illinois law. So truthfully, this is all about, there is nothing preventing the city from releasing them this year.
Except their complicity with corruption and their participation
mm-hmm.
with a criminal organization, the Fraternal Order of the Police, which
right.
they've allowed to operate as a protection racket for people who brutalize citizens in this town and who shouldn't be cops. But so one of the things that was very interesting is, to me, you referred to a database.
Yes.
You demonstrated to me that younger generations are more savvy at using the computer to obtain information and make it available instead of obscure it, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that and mm-hmm. mention the database?
Yes. So the database we were referring to is the Citizens Police Data Project. And you can Google that, Citizens Police Data Project, or go to cpdp.co. But when you go in there, you can search and click around through your neighborhood, through your school zone. You can search by officer name if you have it. And that allows these documents and this data to be accessible and understandable by the public. Because many people, the reason why we have this art installation is many people have never seen a complaint record before. Because they're not just laying out there in the public usually. And so we try to have this website tries to make the data understandable, easy to see, and then make the documents also available so that people can click in and read the stories.
Is the database specific to Chicago?
It is. Illinois has some of the most transparent public records acts, which allows us to set a standard of transparency that the rest of the country reaches out to us to say, how can, in New York, there's a fight to get police names or police misconduct files public as well. And if they win that fight, and as they try to win the fight to repeal Amendment 50A, then they too will want to make a database like this.
So you're helping groups around the country, maybe
yes.
even around the world, understand that there's power in the information and they can access tools or create tools
yes.
to use it.
Absolutely. We have friends in many cities, and we don't personally make CPDP in other cities right now, but we encourage people to talk with us about best practices and what we've learned over the past 5 years of making this database.
And how did you come to this issue?
How did I personally come to this issue? I actually, the killing of Laquan McDonald, actually, which my like colleague Jamie Calvin broke that story of how he was shot 16 times, and that's when I started working for the Invisible Institute.
Okay, so are you a journalist? Like,
I am not personally a journalist. I'm an educator, and I work with young people and do public education installations.
Okay.
So I work on public strategy.
Real education. Empowering education.
Yeah. But I work closely with them. We have a team of, we are a journalism organization.
Is that the Invisible Institute?
Yes. But there's a team, there's a part of the team that is full-on investigative journalists. And then there's some lawyers, there's some data scientists, and there's some like public educators like me. So we're a pretty diverse team, but we're grounded in journalism.
One more question. What's your position on CPAC and the role it would play in advancing the cause of justice, which is what you're all about too?
Yeah, absolutely. So just so you know, the Invisible Institute, like, because we're a journalism organization, we cannot take any like official stances. But for me as Myra, I support CPAC. I think it would make a big difference in terms of the ways that the public can actually be a part of accountability instead of only like we're forced to protest. Only our protests right now is our main way of public engagement, right? But CPAC would actually enable civilians to have a role in accountability. I don't think that CPAC will cure every problem.
No.
But it would take us leaps and bounds further than what we've seen so far.
It would democratize many communities that are terrorized right now.
Exactly.
It would also demonstrate to individuals within communities that they have meaning if they want to participate.
Yeah, yeah.
And get engaged.
Yeah.
The difference between defund the police and CPAC seems to be confusing some people. You're an educator.
Mm.
CPAC would defund the police if that's what the community
exactly
decided,
exactly.
Or maybe they decide that the police needed to be social workers and community healthcare workers.
Right. So yeah, no, this is interesting because with transparency, there's money involved in releasing the records, right? Like they have to redact the documents, they have to digitize them. So defunding the police is primarily about taking away money and taking away power from the police department. So it is an overall demand to cut the budget, right? That doesn't mean that you don't necessarily fund CPAC because that would cost money. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to release the records because that costs money. The question is about what are the budget priorities? And we, overall, the goal is to cut money from the police department.
The social value is being demanded now by
yes.
the community, which is... had enough.
Right. And if you look at the Black Abolitionist Network that helped to launch the Defund CPD campaign, in their list of 11 more specific demands, passing CPAC is one of them. So I recommend looking at that. They include closing Homan Square, getting cops out of schools, implementing CPAC. So yeah.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Very cool.
So here at the corner of Homan and Fillmore, in a reversal of roles, you've got people with their bikes lined up along the curb, facing off against Chicago police with their riot helmets and their billy clubs, their face shields on the north side of Fillmore. They're protecting the Freedom Square. Still quite a extensive cultural program ongoing, still at least 400 people here, maybe more. Some people going and coming. On the other side of the street, you've got more cops with billy clubs, plastic shields. There's probably 60 cops on the other side of Holman, and another 40 cops on Fillmore, cooling it in the shade. Cops obsoleted at Freedom Square. About your sign?
Education is essential, and my sign says Teachers for Black Lives, CP,
hashtag CPD out of CPS.
And you've got a free Angela button, a historic button actually by the hairdo.
Yes.
So you can you say something about what got you involved here?
Yeah, so I'm a teacher in Chicago Public Schools, and I, you know, the injustices that we are here protesting are injustices that I see every single day in my classroom, whether it's a student coming in who didn't sleep the night before, has unstable housing, or a student who is facing abuse from, you know, a narcotics addicted parent who isn't getting the services that they need from the justice system, or they're incarcerated and that child doesn't have the support at home that they need. On top of that, CPD or CPS doesn't receive adequate funding, so I pay for my classroom out of pocket, and as a result, you know, those the more white dominant schools on the north side of Chicago, you know, get much more funding toward their students, and those of us who have to kind of scrounge on the lower level for stuff for our classroom are unable to deliver the same academic, you know, experience that kids on the north side are receiving, or, you know, white kids are in Chicago are receiving.
What would you say the difference is financially?
Financially?
Yeah, you have to come up with $1,000 for resources that north side schools would normally have.
Well, it's not just about resources. Resources would be a quick, you know, fix, and it would solve a lot of the issues that we're talking about. But it's also just in decolonizing the curriculum that we teach students. We're teaching students a history that is, you know, very whitewashed and very almost propaganda for our students to be learning, and we're not teaching them how to be anti-racist individuals, how to take down these systems. See a student go into lunch, or you see a student in a classroom learning about, you know, what we're talking about here, John Burge, he's learning about it in the classroom, and then he goes to lunch and he sees CPD officers patrolling the lunchroom. It's just, what kind of message are we sending to our students that way? So it's not just about resources, it's about disabling some of those systems. If we want to talk about money, Chicago Public Schools have a $33 million budget with CPD, so each school is allocated $180,000 for a permanent, what they call a school resource officer. And that school resource officer is essentially a police officer who's there in, you know, his uniform and funneling black and brown kids into, you know, the school to prison pipeline, where we say they go to school to get an education, but black youth are four times more likely to end up in the incarceration
system. Do you see that in the
system.
School that you work in?
Yes, absolutely.
And is it a high school or grammar school?
So I teach middle grades, so middle school, but, you know, sixth through eighth grade, that's when students are starting to be labeled by administration, labeled by their school resource officer. And the ironic part is that if a school doesn't want to take that resource officer, they can't have that $180K for funding for something else that students would actually benefit
like
from.
Social worker,
school nurse. I think it's like one in every five schools has a school nurse every day.
How many school nurses are in your school?
Zero.
How many social workers?
We have one. We're lucky to have one. Yes.
Is that full-time or part-time during the week?
Full-time, but with, you know, almost 1,000 students, that when you do the math to this, the minutes that each student needs by law to work with that social worker, those students aren't getting the services that they need. So.
And are you on the south or the west side or north side? Or?
So I am teaching in Marquette Park, southwest side.
Is that your first teaching assignment?
No, I actually just finished teaching 2 years in Gary, Indiana. I was teaching at a public charter school there.
Are you at a charter school here?
No, a traditional neighborhood Chicago public school.
And how do you characterize the difference?
I think Gary is facing a lot of the same issues that Chicago is facing in its schools. But Chicago has, you know, a teachers union, a very strong public school system. Gary's public school system has been, the Gary School Corporation has been absolutely gutted by legislators in Indianapolis who have money coming under the table to be funding private education and public charter schools. So as a result, the Gary public schools have just left to be literally abandoned. And, you know, more crime is able to fester in those abandoned spaces. So a lot of the same issues that Chicago faces, but not quite the national media attention that Chicago schools get, which leads to thus, you know, less talent going into the school, you know, fewer resources,
It's like the way they dealt with the industrial core of Gary as it was being
right.
defunded and liquidated.
Right. And, you know, white flight to Merrillville, just south of it. So Merrillville has great schools. And as a teacher, I collaborated a lot with Merrillville teachers, but it was difficult at a certain point to be able to relate with teachers who are teaching the same curriculum, the same grade level, all of that. We just are having such different experiences in the classroom because of the way our schools and our school systems and our communities that we serve have been neglected by the state. So,
the campaign to get police out of the schools, where do you see that currently?
I am, you know, relatively new to CPS, so I am trying my best to learn, you know, all of the LSC systems, the aldermen, all of the different, you know, councils that work, the Chicago Public School Board of Education, the city council. And it's definitely a complex process in terms of, you know, we obviously failed in our major vote to get the Chicago Public Schools Board of Education to cancel its contract with CPS. That was, I believe, a 5-4 vote. But that 5-4 vote to us is a huge victory because in a mayor-appointed, you know, school board of education, you
right.
would expect it to be unanimous.
It's usually been a very complicit with the
right.
mayor's agenda, which
right.
is complicit with the real estate
right.
and banking agenda,
right.
which profits greatly off of
right.
the property that the board controls,
right.
the real estate taxes, the
right.
assessments, and the properties that the board has privatized the operation of.
Mm-hmm.
By firing him.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a little bit of a dead end there, but at least we got in our most recent CPS Board of Education meeting, we are getting closer. We finally got CPS to agree to release a finite list of all the different votes that the LSEs will be taking over the next month. They set, I think the date is August 15th, where they need to set a vote for those SROs in or out of the school. Of course, that leaves them without that funding for something else, but, you know, you shut down that point of access of the school-to-prison pipeline, so that's good. We've seen a few promising schools come out, and so we have momentum on our side, and I hope that it results in more schools eliminating, you know, police officers from their
Are
buildings.
Are you familiar with CPAC?
Yes.
And what's your position on Civilian Police Accountability Council?
I'm absolutely in favor of CPAC. I think that it's a natural solution to this issue of police brutality. You know, we have LSCs. We're lauded as being some of the most democratic processes by having these LSCs. You know, whether that's true in implementation or not is another question, but we have LSCs to oversee our schools. Why don't we have CPAC to oversee our police and to make sure that the police who serve the community really understand and have relationships with the community members?
Do you see the call to defund the police as co-joined with CPAC or competing with CPAC?
That's actually something I'm working, you know, on, you know, orienting in my own mind of, okay, does this mean we're giving more money to police? Does this mean we're giving, is this going to be another COPA, you know, that we...
It mean defund sounds, the police or CPAC?
CPAC. Is CPAC just going to be another, you know, obviously it would be civilians, but will it develop some type of illegitimacy as COPA has? But I think the two can go hand in hand. I think that we can scale down the police department, put that money into other resources, and have oversight at the same time.
Who controls the police force if it's defunded?
That's also something that I'm working through myself, is how do we envision a future without police, or not, you know, completely without police? Maybe that's our end point goal, but how do we create the future to get there? I don't think I'm qualified to speak on that. I don't think I have fully formed that idea in my own mind. That's kind of, I think, why we're here, is to figure that out.
Under civilian control, community representatives would determine whether they wanted to give money to the cops or social workers.
Right. That makes a ton of sense. Very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Nice to meet you. Thank you. Madeline Green.